Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Joining us now, a guest I am so excited for you guys to hear from, Tim Kirkton of ESPN, joining us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing really well. How's everybody there?
We're good. Well, I mean, look, yesterday we were talking about the Mariners being no hit. Not fun. Second time for them this season. And it's really convenient that you're joining us today because we reached out yesterday after your column, which we're going to talk about, and the Mariners were no hit, right? And we were going to just talk about the strikeout rate. Lo and behold, 24 hours before we get to talk to you, there's another no hitter. How about that timing?
It's amazing. And just another reminder how hard it is to get a hit in the major leagues these days. I have never, in 41 years of covering the game, seen stuff like this on a nightly basis. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. And it's not just that 400 pitches, over 400, have been thrown at over 100 miles an hour this year. It's the secondary stuff. It's the curveball, slider, cutter, changeup that everybody has now. Even the pitchers that no one's ever heard of come in firing at 97, you know, with a great secondary pitch. That ultimately is why we've had 6 no-hitters already. That combined with our hitters have been trained by the industry to get the ball in the air, hit a home run. We have lost the value of the hit. We don't really care about hitting a hard ground ball through that hole over there. We want to get the ball up in the air and do some significant damage. And because of that, that's one reason why we have 6 no-hitters and we're on May the 20th.
You know, Tim, you talk about some of that stuff. It's really been fascinating to watch the evolution of the way pitching has been trained and the way that it's been approached. I mean, you've always talked about pitchers and how dedicated they are to their arm and keeping it healthy. Now they're dedicated to making their stuff so much better. What has gone behind that revolution over the past, you know, 5-10 years?
Well, first of all, I just think the pitchers got tired of getting their brains beat out during the steroid era. Just go back 20 years, look at 1999, 2000, the number of runs that were scored, it was ridiculous. So the pitcher said, we're going to go do something about this. And they have, and they've used analytics to do it. Now they know exactly what a hitter likes and what he doesn't like. They know exactly where to throw it. And the difference is the analytics help a pitcher way more if he can improve his spin rate and improve his velocity. It makes him a better pitcher. And yet Joe Maddon has told me for years that all the information that a hitter has about the pitcher doesn't do nearly as much good. Because when Jacob deGrom is locating with that ridiculous stuff that he has, there's just no way you're going to hit him anyway, even if you kind of know what's coming. That's how good the stuff is today, especially from our best pitchers. And I'm a little bit worried, I must say, that as much as cool as it is to have 6 no-hitters already, it's not healthy for the game that the league is batting .232 as a group.
Well, and that's the thing I want to caution fans about, because it's a conversation I've had with other people. And just so that you guys know, we're talking with Tim Kirkton of ESPN, specifically about his column. It just came out on ESPN the other day, how the K became the most destructive letter in Major League Baseball. It's part of this really awesome series called The State of Baseball. This one article in particular takes a really deep dive just into strikeouts. And then as part of your column, you talk to a ton of big names in baseball, one of them Nolan Ryan. And Tim, I was kind of surprised by his reaction on strikeouts, considering his own record. Can you tell us a bit about what he had to say?
Well, he has kind of lost the feel for the game today. He doesn't enjoy watching all these strikeouts, and neither does anybody else other than a few pitchers here or there. But Nolan Ryan said back when he played, you know, the ultimate embarrassment, as he said, was going back and putting your own helmet in the bat rack, which means you struck out. And now it happens all the time, and he just doesn't see where the hitters are embarrassed by it anymore. It used to be that way, but that has changed in the last 20, 15, 10, and especially the last 5 years. things have changed. It's not, you know, it's okay to K now, where when Nolan Ryan pitched and a lot of other people played and pitched, it was not okay to strike out. And the rate has gone up, but I repeat, it's because the industry has allowed this to happen. This isn't even the fault of our hitters. They're told, they're encouraged, they're incentivized to play and swing this way, which is why we have this many strikeouts and six no-hitters this early.
So, Tim, I think that we can all agree that this isn't necessarily healthy for the game of baseball long-term and the entertainment value of the product overall. So what are the adjustments that need to be made as we see this phenomenon occur?
Well, I don't think it's healthy, like you say. And I think the adjustments are going to literally have to start in a batting cage with a bunch of 10-year-olds and tell them, all right, we're going to maybe teach you another way to swing the bat. We're not going to teach you about launch angle and getting every ball up in the air. We're going to teach you to hit it hard somewhere. We're going to teach you that, because frankly, it's just too late for a lot of our big league hitters right now. They've been swinging the same way for 15 years. And now we're asking them to swing a different way, choke up, hit the ball the opposite field. That was not that easy. Believe me, I wrote that in my story. And it's really hard to do that. And then to go do that against Max Scherzer or Shane Bieber, good luck trying something you've been doing for 15 years, now completely change it. That's part of the problem, too. So the adjustment, this is a generational thing. This is going to take years to slow down this K train that we're on, years. And once the hitters decide, we're tired of getting our butts kicked, then they're going to have to go do something different.
Tim, is it really as simple as that, is just simply making that adjustment? Because there's all sorts of conversations of manufactured ways to try and even it out, which is, you know, hey, we're going to lower the pitching mound. We're going to maybe pull it back. We're going to make the distance a little longer. We're going to eliminate the shift. Do you foresee any of those things potentially happening? Or is it just simply a matter of, look, hitters, you've got to adjust?
Well, we're not going to move the mound back. There could not be a worse solution than that. And we're trying in the minor leagues, and we should. But if you, with all the pitchers who get hurt these days, if you really want to see a pitcher get hurt, let's move the mound back a foot. These creatures of habit are now going to say, you know what, I'm only throwing 93 now, where I used to throw 95. And then they try to throw harder, and that's where they're going to get hurt. I think a possible solution, not a long-term solution, a short-term, is to do something with the shift. Because as I wrote in this story, and Ryan Zimmerman I quoted as well as a few others, when you look at the shift, you realize they know where you're going to hit it. If you hit it on the ground over there, as Zimmerman told me, there are four guys waiting there to catch the ball. So if you know that's going to happen, you only have one choice. I'm going to try to hit it over the shift. And when you hit it over the shift, you hit home runs, you hit a double here and there, but you also strike out a million times along the way, and that's part of the problem. So all these solutions are worth examining, especially in the minor leagues, but I don't see a long-term fix with the solutions we have now.
It's one of my favorite things about the article in this series as a whole is the way that baseball is at odds with itself, and I kept thinking, as I was reading it, and you were mentioning pace of play and the league's priorities in there too. We've had, Jake and I, so many conversations before whenever there's a new rule that's very clearly meant to speed up the game or better the offense or make it more exciting, especially for younger fans, at how that feels like, you know, taking, like just moving like an inch when you need to be moving a mile. And it's so interesting to me, and a thought I kept having reading it, is how, like you said, the league is incentivizing something that could be hurting its own product while at the same time being so hyper-focused on trying to solve a problem it's creating, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, I totally agree. And this is what several people I talked to said. Until we start to, and he used the word penalize, people for all these strikeouts, why would they change? These guys are making an enormous amount of money to hit the way that they are. So why would they make a change when they're getting a job every year for millions and millions of dollars? This is where we have to change and start to reward guys for leading the league in hitting. We need to reward them for not striking out. But that process is going to take an awfully long time. But once we've changed that process, I think the hitters will come around and say, all right, they're not paying for me to hit 230 and hit 25 homers anymore. They're not paying. They're paying for something more than that. They're paying at 280 now, not 230. That would make the hitters change, and I think they could make that adjustment. But I repeat, it's going to take some time.
Yeah, and speaking of time, you know, bringing it here to Seattle, Tim, we look at two no-hitters this early in the season. I mean, it's May 20th, and the Mariners have already had two. And we know that it's going to take some time through this rebuilding process that the Mariners have gone through, and they feel like they're starting to come out on the other side of it, yet they still have so many young players. Tim, is it something that Mariners fans should be panicking about this roster, where they're at in the process, or do you think that this is normal, this is par for the course at this stage?
It's normal, and I have no right to say to Mariner fans, you need to be patient when you haven't been to the playoffs since 2001. But you need to be patient. Jared Kelnick's going to be a great player someday. But he's hitting, 179 with one walk so far because it's a really hard game to play. And he's facing pitching every night that he, frankly, has never seen every night. So you have to wait for him to figure this out. When Julio Rodriguez comes up, you're going to have to wait for him too, even though he's probably the best outfield prospect in the game right now. And you would just have to wait for young people to find their way. And it's really hard for a young hitter to figure it out and a young pitcher to figure it out in today's game. Because if you make a mistake with our hitters, as overmatched as they can be, you make a mistake in the middle of the plate, it's no longer a line drive single to left center field. It goes 30 rows up, which partly explains the walk rate today. A lot of our pitchers are just afraid to throw it over the plate. The hitters are bigger, stronger, and better than ever. So it's a crazy circle we got going on now, and I'm worried this circle is going to continue for some time.
Tim, last question for me here, and I'm going a little off base, but again, since part of this is also looking at just where baseball is and some of the bigger conversations, I'd be remiss if I didn't also ask you about one of the bigger conversations we were having yesterday about those unwritten rules of baseball. We were talking about La Russa, Yermin Mercedes, and everything that went on there. What'd you make of all that?
Well, first off, there's so much. This is an hour conversation. I'm going to try to make it quick. Number one rule. The manager gave him the take sign, and he disregarded the take sign and hit a home run when they're up 15-4. Am I upset that anyone swings 3-0 up 15-4? Frankly, no, I'm not upset anymore. When you put a catcher in to pitch, and he's throwing 47 miles an hour, you can swing at any pitch you like. The difference is the manager gave him the take sign. Mm-hmm. And he did not obey the sign. That can't happen in today's game. And Tony La Russa is getting crushed for this. I find that amusing when somebody else did the wrong thing by swinging at a 3-0 pitch. Then the Twins made it even worse when they threw at a guy at 95 miles an hour because he swung at a pitch at 47 miles an hour on 3-0. That doesn't follow either. So I have a lot of problems with all of this, but those who want to crush Tony La Russa for this, let's say it for a third time. He gave the take sign, and his own player said, no, I'm not listening. That's unacceptable. Sorry.
Good stuff, Tim. We've loved this conversation. And by the way, you guys, Tim's latest column is on ESPN, How the K Became the Most Destructive Letter in Major League Baseball. Great stuff. A great read. Highly recommend it. Tim Kirkjian of ESPN. Tim, thanks so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. See ya.
See ya.
Thanks, Tim.
All right, don't forget, it's not too late to enter to win a 710 ESPN Seattle smart speaker at 710sports.com/win. We're still giving them away every day in the month of May. And how many days are there in May, Jake?
31.
31 days. People forget that. They forget that there's 31 days. They think there's just 30, DJ. It's a problem.
Yeah, you just got to count the knuckles, right? Isn't that the trick?
Shouldn't we just make it 30 days? Do we need the 31st day?
No, we absolutely need the 31st day. It's the most important of all the days. Anyways, let me tell you more about this. Here's what
because
you do.
Because it's your birthday?
Yeah. We're giving a speaker away every day in the month of May, as I was saying. And then all you'll have to do is say, hey, play 710 ESPN Seattle to your brand new smart speaker, and you can listen to all our shows all day long. How about that? Pretty cool, right? It is 12:15. That means it's time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down to you, Jake. There have been a lot of additions in the NFC West. A lot. Which new addition in the division is going to be the biggest X factor?
The newest addition in the NFC West, to me, that is the biggest X factor. Without question, it is going to be Matt Stafford. Matt Stafford entering into this division, I think, really has the chance for the Rams to really tilt the scales in their favor. If Matt Stafford and Sean McVay can truly be on the same page, and Sean McVay can get the most out of Matt Stafford, and they're able to push the ball down the field effectively again and be able to use all three levels of the field and be able to attack in a strong way, and Matt Stafford isn't turning the ball over, which he has done historically in his past, I think that you're looking at a team that's going to be really difficult to defend, really difficult to stop. So to me, Matt Stafford and entering the NFC West is the biggest X factor, but he's an X factor because I don't think it's a sure thing. I don't think Matt Stafford entering into this division is going to be a surefire successful story. I think there's a lot to be written here still in this tale of the trade of Matt Stafford and the Rams here with this offense.
Second down. Stacy.
DJ.
CBS Sports says the Seahawks are the least likely of all of last year's division winners to repeat. Are you buying it?
I am. Don't be mad at me. But here's the thing. That's not the end of the world, because you don't have to be the division winner to go on and win the Super Bowl, as we've learned from last year's Super Bowl winner, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And in fact, their division rival, the New Orleans Saints, is in here also. So don't feel slighted by CBS Sports, Seahawks fans. Seahawks are the number one team, and I'll explain why I'm buying that in a second. Steelers are number two as the least likely to repeat. Washington football team, because of the return of Dak Prescott in Dallas, I can absolutely see that one. And then you've got the New Orleans Saints and Tennessee Titans rounding out the top five. I think with Seattle, it's not a lack of talent, and it's not a lack of the possibility that they could even repeat 12 wins again, or potentially 13 wins. It's the idea, and I'm leaning on the text line here too, because a texter on the Mac and Jack's text line pointed this out in our opening segment, Jake. Every team in the division got better. You can make the argument that every single team in the NFC West got better, and two other teams just got a lot healthier. It's going to be a lot tougher for Seattle to repeat as division winners. Can they still do it? Absolutely. Do I think that they're one of the better teams, even on this list of division winners? I think that they're better than the Steelers. I think they're better than Washington. I mean, those two teams are still great, but the problem is you're in the toughest division in football. It is not close. It's going to be a tough road, but you've just got to keep reminding yourself that you do not have to win the division to win. You've just got to keep winning.
Third down. All right, Jake. Well, it's Tebow time down in Jacksonville.
As he's officially
signed with the Jaguars. Do you think he'll make the team?
I really have a hard time envisioning that Tim Tebow is going to be a NFL tight end. I just don't think that it's going to work out well. I know that Tim Tebow is in tremendous shape. He's in great shape, but I think that this is too steep of a curve for Tim Tebow. And I think that you're putting him in a position that, it's 8 years removed from his last NFL season. I just don't see it happening. Is it going to be a fun story to watch and keep track of? Absolutely, it will be. I think that's why it's a smart move by Urban Meyer to bring a little bit more media attention to the Jags. Any news coverage is good coverage when it comes to the Jags and where they're at in terms of the hierarchy in the NFL. They're towards the bottom, so they're working their way to become more flashy and become, if you're Urban Meyer, you're used to being the talk of the town. You're used to being a part of one of these prominent programs, and I think Pete Carroll kind of came in with some of that flash as well. But I do not envision Tim Tebow actually making the team.
Fourth down.
I have a question. Jake, this is not an actual fourth down. I have a proposal for you.
Okay.
If Tim Tebow catches an NFL pass, you jump in Lake Washington.
Okay. I mean, that won't be that bad because he at that point, it will be, what, September? August?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's not going to be preseason games, right? Like an NFL game.
NFL game. I'll give you that. I'll say, because I think they'll keep him on for preseason just to make it exciting. And because you can still have your bigger roster. I'll say a regular season NFL game. If Tim Tebow at any point catches a pass in an NFL regular season game, you have to jump in Lake Washington.
Okay, deal. Done.
Okay.
Done.
I love it.
DJ.
I love it. Fourth down to you, Jake. As we all know, or if you don't know, Jake is down in San Diego with Russell Wilson at Camp Russ, some may say. What special guest stopped by your workouts with Russell Wilson today?
Special guest. Very, very cool guest stopped by to come hang out, and it was Drew Brees. Drew Brees, the legendary Drew Brees, came by, swung around, and came and watched the workout and got to talk ball with him and pick his brain. And I think one of the cool things about Drew Brees is, you know, his preparation, the way he took, how seriously he took not only his craft, but his preparation, the habits, the everyday approach that he had to the game is incredible. And you just see, even with him being retired and moving on from ball, how laser focused that guy is and how intentional he is and everything that he does and how he talks. And so it was really cool to have Drew Brees out there with us, you know, kind of checking things out, watching us and just, you know, kind of giving any thoughts or insights into, you know, what he's done. And so it was very, very cool. And it's very cool to see, you know, Russell Wilson and Drew Brees have that relationship. You know, it's also going to be fun to watch what Drew Brees does after football. Does he get involved in things like this? I think it's always hard to be away from the game. And as you've seen Peyton Manning at different points in time, he's stayed involved in football, coaching, being around it to some point or degree. But to have Drew Brees and get to have him there, and my hero, my all-time hero at the quarterback position, man, it was pretty cool.
I'm trying to imagine what it would be like also to just be around really great accomplished quarterbacks if you are not. Like, Jake, you have been a quarterback. You're a quarterback coach. It's different. For me, like, I think of, gosh, was it Kyle Brown? Big Kyle was maybe talking about being at training camp with Brock when you walked up, Russell Wilson walks up, and some other player, was it like Bobby? Some other player who wasn't a quarterback walks up, and everyone's talking, and then Kyle realized, like, oh, I need to go. One of these things is not like the other. I have to leave. That's how I would feel. I'd be suddenly keenly aware of, like, oh, okay, I don't belong here. I need to leave. All right. Now, they always say that you never know how you're going to react in a moment, whether it's grief, whether it's excitement. You can't ever judge anyone's reaction because you never know how you'd react. But I'm judging Corey Kluber's reaction to his no-hitter just a little bit because it's kind of funny and kind of weird. That's coming your way next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey,
brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey, reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own timelines. And in this case, playing you some of the sound you might be hearing on your own timeline. As we know, there was a no-hitter, a no-no against the Mariners the other day. Gross, none of us want to talk about it. And just as we were settling in, just as we were getting used to talking about Turnbull's no-hitter for the Detroit Tigers, you have another one. Yankees' Corey Kluber throws a no-hitter, which is the sixth this season already. That excludes, obviously, Madison Bumgarner's no-hitter, which was not an official no-hitter, but I'm secretly counting it. So let's say seven no-hitters so far this season. That's wild. Wild. Now, we've had Tim Kirkjian of ESPN on with us just a half hour ago, Jake, talking about the strikeout rate in baseball, whether or not it's starting to ruin baseball, how it could be a huge problem in baseball. I think what you can still say, though, even with that in mind, is that no-hitters are really fun for the team that actually gets it done. For the pitcher that actually gets it done, it is such an amazing career accomplishment. No matter the number of no-hitters that are happening so far this year, it's still really hard to do and really impressive. You would think that if it happened to you, you would be ecstatic. You'd be screaming. You'd be excited. So let's turn to Corey Kluber. Go ahead and ask him. Corey, how did that feel?
I know it's fresh. I know it just happened. But what will you remember most about tonight?
I just think it was a lot of fun. You know, I think it was a well-played game on both sides. We were able to scratch a couple runs across in the, I'm not sure it was the fifth or the sixth. But, you know, aside from that, it was a well-played game. And, it was fun to be a part of.
Corey, I'll let you enjoy it. Congratulations on an absolutely fantastic performance tonight.
Thank you very much.
Now, he loosened up a little bit in his next press conference. Go ahead and play that one, DJ.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
You know, I think I was aware of it, just part of, pitching and stuff, you're aware of what's going on. But
woo!
Probably didn't really start thinking about it until maybe after the sixth. I think at that point we had gotten a couple runs. So, obviously you get the couple run cushion, it makes it a little bit easier to kind of pound the strike zone and know that you got that run support, in your back pocket.
Do you feel your blood pumping?
Wow. I am like in tears. Like I can't believe he is so emotional about that special accomplishment, right? Like, I mean, do you dream of those moments when you're in that position, that Kluber was just in? I mean, it's just dripping off of him. So DJ asked the question earlier in our show in three questions, is throwing a no-hitter cool anymore? Well, Corey Kluber might be putting into question how cool it actually is. Like, are you kidding me? A no-hitter is one of the great accomplishments in sports. So there's either two things, okay? There's either two things that you can say. Either it's becoming way too common that nobody cares about it anymore, not even the pitchers themselves think it's a cool accomplishment, which is bonkers to me, okay? And the second thing is that Corey Kluber is just extremely boring. And you wonder why baseball doesn't have strong personalities? Well, okay, maybe it's filled with, littered with guys, like that. I mean, Corey Kluber, it has this special, special moment that in other sports, I mean, you would see guys emotional, excited, fired up, pumped up, whatever the case may be. And Corey Kluber's like, nah, yeah, it was cool. It was fine. It was, it was like,
it was
fine. Really,
it was whatever.
It was cool. Like, I knew it was coming. And it happened.
I knew I'd get a no-hitter.
Are you kidding me?
It's not really exciting. I kind of wish he would have leaned into
it. Losing my mind.
I wish he would have leaned into that and been like, I don't know. I mean, it's not that special. I don't know why you're asking me. I can just have people baffled, reporters so confused. Like, wait, what? Why I'm asking you? Yeah, it's whatever. It's not a big deal. Haven't you done it? Very chill. Very just chill Corey Kluber is what I want to see.
Way too chill Corey Kluber.
Way too chill Corey Kluber. The NHL draft lottery odds have come out, Jake, and the Seattle Kraken have the third best odds at the number one overall pick in the 2021 NHL draft. It's 10.3%, a 10.3% chance they could get the number one overall pick. Here's the good news. 100% chance that you get a top five pick. You are guaranteed a top five pick. And they will have the third pick in rounds 2 through 7. So good, exciting news. I mean, the Kraken is still a little, not a little bit away. The season's still a little bit away this fall. Obviously, the draft coming in, 2 months from now, 2-ish months around there, later this summer. So plenty of reason to be excited. How are you feeling about going to your first ever game?
Well, it's going to be special. I mean, that part of it, no doubt, is going to be special. And it's going to, the energy in the building is going to be, crazy. I mean, you talk about the excitement for the Seattle Kraken. It's legit. I mean, you have a strong contingency of hockey fans here in Washington. I mean, it's no surprise. It didn't happen by accident that as soon as they put, season tickets up for sale, they instantly, sold out. So people are fired up, excited about the Seattle Kraken. It's going to be really fun to keep track of how the team is being built, how it's being constructed, and ultimately having our first NHL game here in Seattle. It will be special. And it's also another, tip of the cap to the state, to the city, to the region, of having another professional sport here in Seattle. So you talk about, media markets, you talk about professional sports. It is becoming and growing, being one of the better, sports towns, sports media markets in the country. Now, Stacey, we all know what they're missing and what they need to kind of cap it off. And I think that will come shortly after we see a successful season with the Seattle Kraken.
All right, looking around the college football landscape, the SEC pulled out the credit card, did a little swipe, and sent out a couple $1 million to each of its member schools to help make up from COVID losses. The $322 million that it distributed to schools is going to be from future revenues through media rights, and that doesn't start until 2025. So this is basically borrowing from the money they are sure to make in the future to be able to give some money to schools now. Now, it's not a bad idea to make up for those financial losses, to give schools, especially in the SEC, a boost and keep other programs alive. But it begs the question that DJ wrote down, and we're still not paying college athletes?
Yeah, there's just not enough money, Stacey.
There's not enough money to go around. Look, do you want a flat screen above each locker, or do you want to be paid? I mean, make up your mind. You know what I mean?
Right, correct. I mean, do you want crazy facilities that that get renovated every 3 years in the SEC, or do you want to get paid? don't you want your administrators or Mark Emmert to make millions of dollars?
Or do you buy lunch? I don't know. It's up
that's
to you.
Really, really important. So, I mean, if you don't care about those things, that's fine. You can get paid, but you're just not going to have the NCAA operate the way it needs to be.
Right.
So. It's a joke. I mean, every time we see stuff like this, it just is a continual reminder that the NCAA, the structure of it, it's a joke. And it's great that athletes and trust me, I greatly appreciated my college education. Mm-hmm. I greatly appreciated not having to go in debt and being able to have that paid for. But the money and the revenue that you bring in as an athlete and the lifestyle that you live, it is a professional business. It make no mistake about it. And so I think I always find it fascinating, all the amount of money and everything that it generates and the revenue that it brings in. And, the athletes are just barely starting to get any piece of that money.
Now, Jake, I don't mean to put you on blast, but what the heck is happening with your camera? If you're watching us on 710sports.com/video, where you could tune in every single
falling.
Day and watch us, people have commented about this. People who are watching this stream are commenting, what's happening with Jake's camera?
I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on. I have it like propped up in a certain spot, and I've never had this issue before, but my phone keeps flipping down, and
it's been
I don't know what's going on. I'm doing it the same thing every time that I've done it before. I don't know what's going on. So I'm sorry for everybody who's watching the stream. I'm probably making you sick here. So I'll do my best to keep it strapped on there.
All right. This offseason brings the most important test, the most important leadership test for two Seahawks veterans. We'll tell you why and who they are next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jerry DePoto talked with Danny and Gallant this morning. We're going to play you some of that sound coming up in about 15 minutes. Before we get to that, though, a quick Seahawks discussion, because this offseason, not only yet again another weird offseason affected by the COVID pandemic, but also an offseason where the NFLPA and Jim Treader are potentially asking players to kind of group together, decide to forever change offseason program or offseason activities, all of which are mandatory but are voluntary but have always been treated like they're mandatory. And I'm paraphrasing what he's saying, but the idea is, hey, we realized this last offseason that we don't actually need to be training in the offseason the way that we have been for the last however many years. Maybe, like so many other companies have changed in light of COVID, we can also change the way that we prep. So if that happens, and we have yet to know for sure because we haven't yet had mandatory mini camp, which is next month. But if that happens, it falls on two important Seahawks players to make sure that the team is ready and to become every bit the leader that they have been, but certainly need to be in order to prepare for this team. Who are those two players?
You're going to need Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner to step up and be the leaders that they are and be the captains that they are and be the two highest paid players in this organization that they are to navigate through this process. And you saw it happen last year during COVID, in limited, limited ways in which they could, but you saw Bobby Wagner get some of the guys defensively together and work on and do some 7-on-7 stuff, work through that with Marquise Blair and KJ Wright and, you know, a couple of other Seahawks on the defense side of the ball. You saw Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf getting together, bringing in Greg Olsen, Philip Dorsett, you know, and trying to get to work with those guys. And I think that is going to have to be ramped up here if they are not going to participate in OTAs, right? That's just mm-hmm. the straight up honest truth. And you're seeing other teams around the league, not every team by any stretch of the imagination, but you're seeing somewhat around half the teams in the league, a lot of them being, you know, teams that have new coaches or teams that have a new quarterback that, you know, there's extra incentive to want to be in the building because they need to learn. I think when you have a veteran heavy group like the Seahawks are, they are okay with stepping back and being away from OTAs, right? They don't feel like they need that in order to properly prepare physically and mentally. The only caveat to that is that with the Seahawks, you do have a new offense with Shane Waldron. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like you can get everything you need out of it in terms of the learning that has to be done and the way that you need to execute with a new offensive coordinator? I personally believe that they can.
Now, I don't actually agree with this sentiment, but I understand the sentiment. So I'll start by saying that. What would you say then to someone who says, you know how I think you can be a great leader? By showing up to OTAs and by modeling for your teammates that you're going to be there.
Well, I would say that there is a lot going on. I think that there is still a process that, you know, in terms of conversations that need to be had behind closed doors. I also think that when you're talking about leadership, you can lead in different ways, and you can lead by getting guys together in the offseason and not necessarily having to show up to the building itself. And would you say the same thing to Tom Brady?
That
would be my question.
You being a leader means showing up?
Yeah, because Tom Brady's not showing up, right? Like, we talk about the GOAT, we talk about these comparison games and all that. I mean, you know, they did the same exact thing last year. They were able to make it work. They're not showing up again this next season. The only argument, the counterpoint to that is, well, Tom Brady's not having to deal with a new offense this offseason. He dealt with a new offense last year, and they found a way to make it work to the point where they won a Super Bowl. So I do think that it is workable. Technology's incredible. Virtual meetings, they've been able to get a lot done. It's just a matter of continuing to keep working with your teammates to develop that chemistry and to make sure you're on the same page so that when you get to training camp, you're hitting the ground running and you're not feeling like you're having to start, you know, from the very, very, very beginning of it. So it's going to require Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner to take some extra ownership if they're not going to participate, and to get guys together and to work through some of the playbook stuff and on the field with routes. And I think both of these guys will accept that challenge and will do that.
Now, I don't agree with the argument that I see people make, not now, not seeing people make it now, but that I've seen people make, which is somehow in some people's minds, players don't want to go to OTAs because young people, anyone playing in the league right now is young enough to be playing in the league, that young people don't care. Young people don't try. They don't like hard work. Let me tell you what, these players are getting up at like 5 a.m. to work out. They're playing through like random injuries that are incredibly painful. Like they work hard. Like, let's stop there. But I mean, with people that say, oh, they don't want to work, they're not doing this, what argument would you make that says, like, this is why a player may argue against having OTAs or against having the off season that you had that looks more like 2019?
Right. There's two arguments. Number one, Tom Brady made it himself in an NFLPA conference call in a meeting, and just pointing to the other professional leagues out there around the world where they don't have when it's the off season, they don't have a period of time where they're coming in and replicating heavy practices in the off season. And that's what OTAs is. It's not necessarily you're putting on the pads, but you are out there doing team drills and putting yourself in compromising situations. That is going on, and you're cutting down your off season. The other part of it is that the NFL didn't always used to operate this way, Stacey. A little history lesson for you. The OTA period only happened after the Dallas Cowboys run. Why? Because you had a coach in Jimmy Johnson who came from the college ranks and was used to spring ball and went outside of the rules, stretched the rules a little bit in the NFL, Stacey, to the point where they were running their own OTAs and they were winning Super Bowls. And so what did the rest of the NFL do? It's a copycat league. You can't have one team doing something without everybody else wanting to do it. So they changed their mode and their mentality from, hey, show up, you have your full off season, you show up in training camp, which started in the beginning of July. They changed it. They added OTAs and shifted the start of training camp to the end of July. So that's really kind of the history of it all. And I think that players are looking back at it at this point in time and saying, we can learn virtually. We don't need to put our bodies physically at risk before it is necessary. Let's wait till training camp and we'll see if there's actually any change made. But I seriously, Stacey, I don't believe that's going to happen. But in the meantime, Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, they need to show their leadership and get guys together to make up for that.
It's an interesting thing to keep tracking. Again, that mandatory mini camp still a little bit away. Going to happen next month, but you got some OTAs coming up here next week. All right, Jerry DePoto was on with Danny and Gallant this morning. You can hear what he had to say next.